Welcome to the Beeson Podcast, coming to you from Beeson Divinity School on the campus of Samford University. Now your host, Doug Sweeney.
Welcome to the Beeson Podcast. I'm your host, Doug Sweeney, and I'm joined today by Professor Sandra Richter, who is this year's Biblical Studies lecturer here at Beeson Divinity School. Dr. Richter holds the Robert H. Gundry Chair of Biblical Studies at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. She is known for her work in the book of Deuteronomy and is also the author of The Epic of Eden, a Christian entry into the Old Testament, and the much-loved series of video Bible study curricula that have grown from that project. Dr. Richter, it's great to have you at Beeson this week. Thank you for joining us.
It is really wonderful to be here. Thank you for the warm invitation, your fabulous students, and so much hospitality coming from your community.
It's a wonderful place. Let's introduce you to podcast listeners who don't already know about you.
Okay.
Tell us just a little bit about how you came to faith in Jesus, how you got into teaching the Bible.
It's a long, convoluted tale, actually. So I'm currently at Westmont College, which is in Santa Barbara, California. And before that, I was at Wheaton College. And before that, down in Jackson, Mississippi, at Wesley Biblical. And before that, Asbury Theological. So I'm slowly making my way west. I think the next one is Hawaii.
The ocean somewhere. Okay,
maybe.
Hawaii, that'd be nice.
That would be nice. Yeah. So I came to faith at the tail end of the Jesus movement in the Washington, D.C. area. So I'd been raised a Catholic, really had no understanding of a personal faith, wandered across the street into a coffee house, essentially, had a bunch of teenagers tell me about Jesus, and I said yes. So that's how it started. And I really had I didn't know about ministry. I didn't know about Protestants, let alone the fact that there are all these different avenues to serve God.
Where were you living at that time?
Maryland.
Okay.
So the Maryland side of Washington, so Potomac, Maryland, if that means anything to anyone. And so I started this journey, and somewhere along the way, in my late high school years, someone dropped the book, The Cross and the Switchblade, into my hands, which is the story of Teen Challenge. And I read this book, and I was captivated by what they were accomplishing. So I went to one of the leaders in my little house church, because, again, this is the Jesus movement, and I told her that this book had captured my heart, and I couldn't sleep at night, and I needed to find these people, and I needed to help them. And she explained to me that what I was experiencing was a call to ministry. And I said, oh, okay, what's that? And she said, well, it means you need to go to a Bible college. And I said, oh, okay, what's that? And through a comical sequence of events, I wound up at a little Assemblies of God Bible College in Pennsylvania. And wound up working in Teen Challenge in Philadelphia, women's induction. Every summer I was in college and was trained in ministry. So that's how it started. And then I went into youth ministry, educational, music, all that, you know, support roles basically as a minister in the Assemblies. And that's trekking along, you know, doing just fine. Until I landed in Western Massachusetts, and I was so aware that I was underprepared for ministry. In fact, that took about 10 minutes, but this was my first opportunity. And I was within commuting distance of Gordon-Conwell. So I started driving in to take classes to fill in the gaps.
Were you there because of a church assignment, or
yes.
why were you there?
Yeah, I was, I was there working in a youth ministry group. And it was a big old church out in Springfield, Mass, for people who know the area. And so I started driving in, and I was picking up classes like Growth in the Small Church, or Intermediate Hebrew, or, you know, how to light your youth group on fire, and Old Testament hermeneutics, and just sort of gathering what I thought I needed. No intention of getting a degree, because I didn't need one. And then as this all started coming together, before you know it, I have a master's degree, and I got this opportunity to teach as an adjunct at an even smaller Christian college, Zion Bible Institute in Providence, Rhode Island. And I was hired to do one semester of intro to Old Testament.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, I was praying about God's direction in my life. I walked into the classroom. Holy Spirit met me there and made it very clear that we were about to experience a career shift. And that career shift was into the academy and a PhD and all that fol-de-rol. And
yeah,
that's how I landed here.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting story for somebody who went on to Harvard for a PhD.
Yes.
You must have done well in Bible college.
Well, honestly, when Harvard accepted me, I was probably the most surprised person. It's funny how you move through your life in ministry thinking that you're average, I guess, and Harvard's not average, so I guess they saw something in my test scores or GPA that communicated the same.
Was there a prophet, Gordon Conwell, who was especially helpful, or did somebody recognize, oh, she's really good with Hebrew, or any of that kind of thing?
Not really. I'm old, and in my day, it was completely a man's world, and I was honestly invisible in most contexts. So it took the Holy Spirit nudging. And then when I went back to my profs and said, do you actually think I could manage a PhD? Then I started getting, oh, yeah, you can do that. But actually volunteering it, no, not so much.
Okay. Well, now that you're talking about it was a man's world, you know, Beeson has a growing number of female students. Probably there are prospective female students listening to this podcast. And a lot of them, I mean, on the one hand, we're in a generation where our experience was a little bit different than people's experiences today. On the other hand, a lot of young women still struggle with thinking about, can I be called to ministry?
Yes.
Should I go to seminary? Do you have advice that you give to young women when they ask you about that?
I do. And I come mostly from the Wesleyan world, which at this point is very supportive of women in ministry. But there are a lot of other arenas where women are not. And so I think the first thing I would want to say is that I am convinced that the scriptures support women in ministry. I'm not pursuing and have not pursued that calling or that topic simply responding to cultural norms. I would want to say that up front. For women who are listening to this podcast right now, you know, at this point, I'm an endowed chair in biblical studies and publishing in multiple venues and welcome in most pulpits.
You're one of the best known Old Testament professors in the country.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I'll take that one home. But that certainly isn't the way it started. And God has been faithful over and over and over again. So again, if you've got prospective students who are listening to this, I want to encourage them to listen to the Holy Spirit, to respond to their calling, and to know that it is He who equips and He who opens doors. And if we're faithful to Him, He'll be faithful to us. And that is absolutely my story. The doors that opened for me should never have opened. According to the cultural norms surrounding me, I have spent my entire career sitting in rooms where I was the only woman in the room, and yet God was faithful. So I want to encourage them. Yeah.
That's an encouraging word. All right, let's move forward a little bit in the history of your ministry.
Yeah.
How did you figure out being a sort of a big-time Harvard woman, how to balance the technical scholarly stuff that Harvard professors train you to do, on the one hand, with your ongoing passion for ministry in the church, on the other hand? Was that a tough balancing act for you, or was it just natural given what the Lord had done in your history?
Goodness, I would say it's kind of both. So when you're doing the PhD, right, your university, your mentors have certain ambitions for you, and you share this story, right?
Sure.
And there are certain projects that earn you points in the guild. I heard someone call it once the union card, right?
Yes.
So those things have to be done to build credibility. And it's hard work. And sometimes it's not intuitive work because it seems very narrow. And sometimes it's hard to track how one might be glorifying God or building the kingdom, you know, spending 6 months on the etiology of the verb shakan, you know? But what I also found as I got dropped into this pond, which was much bigger than the pond I came from, that everything my professors had to teach me in some fashion or another filled out my understanding of the Old Testament, of the world of the Old Testament, of the people who lived in the Old Testament. And honestly, I'm sort of flipping catalog cards in my brain. I don't think there's a single class I had to take that didn't feed into my understanding of God and his Bible and his people in some fashion or another. But I watched a lot of people around me, a lot of folks who came into the Harvard program as faithful churchmen and churchwomen with what I would have called a very real faith. And they wound up shipwrecked in the process.
I had friends like that too.
Yeah. And as I watched this happen, I concluded in my own mind that a major reason that I and others like me didn't wind up shipwrecked is because when we walked into the program, our faith was already our own. It didn't belong to our mentors. Yeah. It didn't belong to our pastors. It didn't belong to our parents. Mm-hmm. We'd already had to fight for it in our own world. Yeah. And so having to fight for it in the university PhD program was nothing new.
Mm. Did you have to fight for it? Did you have professors who tried to undermine it?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Yeah. Not only because their worldview was such that they didn't credit the potential of the supernatural, which is the bottom line, right?
Yeah.
Because for God to reveal himself to humanity requires that God exists, that the supernatural is possible, and that God intervenes in human history. These are presuppositions that do not exist in a post-Renaissance world, post-Enlightenment world, right? So I would have profs who were just in that category. But then I also had a number of profs who had started their journey as faithful believers, had been turned aside from their own faith in the process, and they were out to do the same for their students.
Yeah, I had several of those too.
Yeah, and what I found so interesting is the ones who had the most conservative upbringings, again, my armchair analysis, they had come to associate their early faith with being academically unrespectable. I might be making that word up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they saw their origins of faith as kind of hillbilly origins, and they wanted to put that as far away from them as they possibly could.
Yeah.
And then I walked through the door, and they recognized me.
Yeah.
They recognized the language I used. They recognized the dress code.
Mm-hmm.
They recognized the moral code, and a few of them really went after me as a result, which made for some very painful exchanges. But I survived, learned a lot, and it prepped me for the rest of the academic world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So let's tell our listeners a little bit. We'll major on the Epic of Eden and what you're doing now and those sorts of things. But everybody have fun getting at least a little bit of information on the more technical scholarly work that you've done.
Okay.
Tell us how you got started sort of as an OT scholar.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of an odd story. When I started going back to seminary to fill in the gaps, because I had this Bible college education, I realized that all the gaps were in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a thesis that folks will hear, especially in my popular publications, all the time. The Old Testament, forgive me, it's harder than the New Testament.
Yeah.
It's a bigger canon. It's thousands of years earlier. There are a whole bunch more characters on the screen, and the cultures are much more foreign. So I'm filling in my gaps as a student and finding myself in Gary Pratico's archaeology classes and Meredith Klein's hermeneutic classes, right? And that starts snowballing as I'm moving forward. And that process is how I wound up applying for a PhD in Hebrew Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And my degree specifically is a university degree. It's not a divinity school degree. So I'm Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations. So I will often tell people that whereas exegesis is the task of dropping a paragraph, a chapter, an oracle into its biblical context, my degree program was the process of dropping the Old Testament into its context. Okay. And all of that education has been so incredibly profitable for me in the task of interpreting the Old Testament. So I think you asked me how I got started in it.
Yeah, what kind of work did you do that was technical as an Old Testament scholar? I mean, you're very well known today for speaking in churches and the Epic of Eden and things that are a little bit more accessible.
Right,
but
right.
But you also earned your stripes as a technical scholar.
And I'm honestly still earning my stripes all the time. So my dissertation in particular grew out of what we used to call the 200 seminar. And any Nelke out there who's listening to me is like, oh, yeah. Because the 200 seminar is basically Harvard's hazing ritual. Mm. If you survive it, you get to have your PhD. So you present a technical paper to the entire department. They'll have 3, 4, 5 faculty members there, and anyone who's active in the program is there as well. You present your paper, they spend 2 hours tearing you apart, and if you, you know, if you survive, you get to go forward. So early on, I think it was my second paper, I was assigned, the theme was divine presence and temple in Old Testament Hebrew, Israelite religion. Let's get the categories right. And I wound up assigned the Deuteronomic view of divine presence in the temple. And anyone in my field knows that Deuteronomy, the D source, is the second stage of Wellhausen's evolution. And the D source Deuteronomy is supposed to embody the second of 3 stages of Israel's deity evolving from the simple to the complex. So I dive into this topic. I find that the Wellhausians and their disciples, the name theologians, have come up with this entire rubric of how God's presence is to be understood in the book of Deuteronomy. It has to do with a particular idiom that shows up in Deuteronomy a dozen times, and it's the place I choose to place my name, Lashakin Shemosham or Lasum Shemosham. And the running theory was that the name was a hypostasis of the Almighty. And hypostasis means a semi-incarnate presence of the Almighty in the temple. So as I did the research with all of the training I had received from my professors, I found out, no, it's not. In reality, it's an Akkadian idiom that has been borrowed into the text. And the Akkadian idiom is almost always associated with conquering kings who have claimed new territory. So not only did it upset the apple cart of the name theologians who controlled the discipline at that time, but it also introduced this lovely new reality that Yahweh, the great conquering king of Israel's history, is claiming an idiom that goes back to Gilgamesh and before, and identifying himself as the great conquering hero of Israel's story. He has placed his name, i.e. his inscribed monument, in the land of Israel. Mm. This place is mine. And if you want to argue about it, you're talking to me. I mean, that's the bottom line of what the idiom means. And then if you've read Deuteronomy recently, you know that in chapter 27, the children of Israel are instructed to set up 2 large stones. I love the fact that they call them big stones, because the technical term is matseva or matsevot, which is the ancient word for a stela, a monument. But that word had been used so often by the indigenous Canaanite population that our theologian in Deuteronomy will not use it. So instead, he describes it, set up 2 big stones. clean up the surface, coat it with lime, and write in ink all of these words that I've given you. In other words, Yahweh has placed his name, his inscription, in the land of Canaan, on Mount Ebal, and has declared himself the conquering king of Deuteronomy. So that was my first big foray into what we do.
Did you get into trouble with other scholars for upsetting that apple cart?
Oh my gosh, did I get into trouble? And it started actually in the 200 seminar, because the man who had done the most work on the idiom is a man named Sean McBride, actually S. Dean McBride, and is a Harvard grad, very well respected. And he'd never actually gotten his dissertation published. And turns out one of his besties was on the committee that was evaluating my seminar paper.
Oh.
So like a good Harvard student, I had done all my research. I had dug dusty dissertations out of the archives and had read and redeployed his research.
All right. You were going after this guy's best friend.
Exactly. Having no idea that I was going after this guy's best friend. Yeah. And once you do the linguistic work, again, it's fairly obvious what you're bumping into. This is a very common idiom in the monumental tradition of Mesopotamia. But of course, do biblical studies people actually talk to Assyriologists? You know, not in the regular world. So we were missing this massive connection. And this same idiom had been translated into the Amarna letters, and it had been translated into an array of Northwest Semitic inscriptions. So it could be found, but you needed to be able to be transdisciplinary, which is what the NELC program champions, is this thing. So when I presented that paper, I made Dean McBride's bestie very unhappy, Paul Hansen. And so they gave me a very hard time. And then, I can tell you the bloody details if you want, but as I continued to work on it after the eviscerating experience in the 200 seminar, I survived, which means I get a PhD. I actually dared to represent it as the prospectus for my dissertation. And the down low information is that I came this close to not having the prospectus approved for the same reasons.
Was Hansen one of the people on the committee who were looking at the prospectus?
Yeah, exactly. Wow. And the down low is that Peter Machinist, and if you're a Nelke right now, you've bowed your head, turned to Professor Hansen and said, "She's got this, let her have it." So I published it. I wrote it, published it with the Germans on purpose, because it's a German article, argument. That's where it started. So it's a BZAW monograph at this point. And then wrote a number of articles spun off of it that involved Mount Ebal. I've written a lot on the archaeology of Ebal. Adam Zertal was the Israeli archaeologist, worked a lot with Ralph Hawkins and Richard Hess and others who have engaged Ebal. And yeah, so that's a big wing. I've done a lot on economics, reconstructing the economy of the Iron Age and trying to place Deuteronomy in its economic setting. Ooh, what else have I done? I've done a good bit of work on Deuteronomy in general. We just this morning talked through the sexual misconduct laws in Deuteronomy. So, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So that's what your Harvard profs taught you to do.
Yes.
But there's this whole other side of you that is active in speaking in churches, writing accessible things for lay Christians and pastors and so on. Was it just your love of the Lord and your teaching ministry that taught you I better use some of my gifts to help the church? Or how'd you get into doing that kind of work?
Yeah, that's actually a very good question. I'm pondering. The church is where I started. So the passion to feed and build the church has never gone anywhere. One of my pet peeves is the fact that in Christian education, we never let our people grow up. We teach them Christian faith 101 over and over
preach it.
And over again. And we do it with our children and our young people. And then we're stunned that they don't understand their own doctrine at the age of 18. Hello. But we also do it with our adults.
Yeah.
And they get bored and they drift off into theological la-la land.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is because we don't challenge them.
Mm.
So, and I'm going to guess you share this opinion.
I do. I've published about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
If there's anything I do that I can't translate into the pews, why am I doing it?
Mm.
That would be my posture.
Yeah, that's great.
It might take a good bit to walk it to the pew, but isn't it our responsibility to walk it to the pew?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've done a whole lot of this kind of work. Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say the Epic of Eden would be the one that most people know about? We've had people on campus this week. I'll refer to just one, my friend, who's a big time judge in our area. And she serves as the chairperson of the Board of Trustees at Samford University.
Oh.
She came to chapel yesterday with that book tucked under her arm. So it's read by lots of people, lots of very smart people, lots of lay people who care a lot about their faith.
Yeah.
And the people listening to us right now who haven't read it probably should know about it and
I
try
think
to read
so.
It. So just give us a little bit. What are you doing in that book?
The Epic of Eden was my first popular publication. And I did it. It was first published in 2008. I'm supposed to be rewriting the second edition that should be finished by the end of this summer.
Okay, it's supposed to be and should be.
Yeah, you know how that works. Supposed to be, should be. But yeah, Rachel, I promise, end of the summer. Okay, my editor at IVP. So that book grew out of my education and experience on all fronts. What I wanted to accomplish with that book was put people's Bible together for them.
Hmm.
I have found over my entire career, as both in ministry and in the academy, people really struggle with the study of the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And they struggle, one, because they don't understand that this is their story. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when I'm talking to my undergrads in particular, I mock them because that's good for them. I mock them for the fact that they would never pick up Harry Potter in book five. Never in a million years.
Oh, good strategy. Yeah.
And if they picked up Harry Potter in book five, they would struggle to figure out if Sirius Black was a good guy or a bad guy, who the kid is with the lightning bolt on his head, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And yet we do that in our Bibles all the time. We open up in Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. We do not understand why this is the sort of announcement that should send fireworks off across the world.
Yeah.
That the son of Abraham, the son of David, has finally shown up. And we don't realize that we've been stripped of two-thirds of our own story, two-thirds of redemptive history. So that's a big reason. The other big issue is getting past that great barrier of history and culture and geography. And the final one is not being able to organize the data that we have. And I call that the dysfunctional closet syndrome. So think Friends, think Monica's closet, a closet that is so cluttered that you can't find anything in it and you can't use anything in it. So the goal of that book is to reintroduce God's people to their people, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to get them past the great barrier of history, geography, and culture, and to organize their closet, and to help them recognize that Eden and the New Jerusalem are the same place, and that everything from Genesis 3 to Revelation 21 is a huge rescue plan. And God's ultimate ambition is to get Adam back in the garden. That's the ambition. And once people can put that framework around their jigsaw puzzle, they can use their Old Testament. Yeah. So that's the big ambition of that one.
That's great. We'll put information about that book in the program notes when we drop the podcast. And we'll also put links in the program notes to the biblical studies lectures that
Wonderful.
You're giving our community this week. Without spilling all the goods and sharing everything right now, just give us a little teaser. We want people to click on those links and watch your lectures.
Okay.
What are you doing in there that they'll benefit from?
So the lectures, we're doing two lectures. One is the question, does the Old Testament dehumanize women? A very important topic in our current culture and society, both because of women's issues, but also this view that the Old Testament is obsolete and that the God of the Old Testament is foreign and misogynistic and violent and all of these other misnomers for the character of the Almighty. So we dive into Deuteronomic law, do two case studies. One is on sexual misconduct, rape in particular, in the Old Testament. And one is on the law of the beautiful POW. I think that would make a good movie title. That's what I think. And then the other lecture we're doing is on environmentalism. Mm. Another issue that I think the church is very misinformed on. Mm. And what I would say is probably the most important topic of social justice and holiness in our current generation.
Oh, my son and daughter-in-law will like that one in particular.
Oh, good.
That's great. All right, we almost out of time.
Okay.
Our listeners are prayers, and they often pray for our students, for Beeson Divinity School, and every once in a while we have them pray for guests on campus and guests like you.
Thank you.
If our people are going to be praying for Professor Sandra Richter in days ahead, what should they pray about? Mm.
Well, if they're listening right this moment, pray for the lecture tomorrow. That it goes smooth.
They'll hear it too late.
Okay. So skip that one. I don't know about you, but I am always in this space where I feel like I am fighting against the limits of time and energy and resources to get the right things done. Mm-hmm. So that issue of priority, energy, focus, to fulfill my calling, you know, which publication projects do I take? Which speaking engagements do I say yes to? Which classes do I teach? And I would love prayer that I make the right decisions, that I am clear-minded and full of energy in investing in those topics, and that I continue to faithfully build the kingdom with those projects. Yeah.
Okay, listeners, this has been Dr. Sandra Richter. She holds the Robert H. Gundry Chair of Biblical Studies at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. She's traveling around the country all the time, speaking in churches. She's trying to balance a very busy life where she does both technical scholarship in the Old Testament and work that's very clearly done in the service of the church and its leaders and its lay people. So please pray for her that she'll get that balance right before the Lord.
Thank you. Very much.
Thanks for tuning in. We love you and we're praying for you. We say goodbye for now.
You've been listening to the Beeson Podcast, coming to you from the campus of Samford University. Our theme music is by Advent Birmingham. Our announcer is Mark Ginolette. Our engineer is Rob Willis. Our producer is Neil Embry. And our show host is Doug Sweeney. For more episodes and to subscribe, visit beesondivinity.com/podcast. You can also find the Beeson Podcast on iTunes, YouTube, and Spotify.